Marlon James, welcome to Booktopia.
Thanks for having me.
It is great to have you here. Now, I want to start with a book that you wrote before your Booker Prize winner, which is John Crowe's Devil, mm-hmm. for which you had 78 rejections, mm-hmm. which is some kind of record. I want to know how you didn't lose faith with yourself mm-hmm. as a writer after you went through that kind of rejection.
Actually, I did lose faith. I did lose faith as a writer. I destroyed the book. I destroyed the manuscript. I destroyed copies of it. I went to my friends' houses and deleted it from their hard drives. I erased all trace that I was a writer. That's how it was. 78. My response to the how did you have the strength? I didn't. Yeah, and
but you did keep sending it out, because to get 78 rejections, right. You had to send it out 78 times,
but rejection number 78, I was like, that's it. I can't do this anymore. So I did destroy it, and I made sure, and I do erase all traces of the book.
Except you didn't, because there was one friend of yours, thank God, who did not do what you asked, did not delete the file from their computer.
But I didn't get it from his computer. I got it from my email account, the outbox, sending to him. And thank God for email, the sent message all still keeps the attachment, and that's how I found it. But
And so that got read by someone who then sent it to an editor in New York, and suddenly, mm-hmm. bang, your fate turned.
My fate, yeah. But I did lose faith, I think. Because I think that's a lot of rejection.
It is a lot of rejection. So, Marlon, what were you going to do after that 78th rejection, when you kind of decided, okay, I'm going to destroy all traces of this manuscript? Mm-hmm. What had you decided you were going to do with your life?
I was in Don DeLillo, like Salman Rushdie. I was in advertising. And I think I just accepted, well, maybe I'm just an ad guy. And maybe I'll stay in this. I could do it. It was very unrewarding. And I was this close to, I'll just join. There are legions of people in the world doing things they don't like, even if they're good at it. So maybe being unhappy is a sign of being mature. I don't know.
Oh, God, I'm glad you didn't have a time. Now, I have to tell you that I heard Bob Marley live at the Hammersmith Odeon.
What?
In 1975 with mm-hmm. Peter Tosh.
Even before, wow, with Peter Tosh.
With Peter Tosh, yes.
That's like before Bob Marley became Bob Marley.
It was a hugely mad concert. He was over an hour late. He was pretty well off his face. And people started ripping chairs out of the Hammersmith Odeon. Uh-huh. Throwing them at the stage. It was a pretty scary concert. Now, around that time, you were about 6 years old, so I want to know, when you were a kid growing up in Jamaica, what did Bob Marley mean to you? Was he like a godlike figure? What was he?
He wasn't a god. He was more of a rebel.
Okay.
Jamaica is still a very order-obsessed British colony. And very proud of, not as proud of it as Barbados it was, but very proud of keeping that kind of propriety, that and service to our glorious queen and all of that foolishness. Marley was just a rebel in all sorts of ways, from his clothes, certainly the hair, being a Rastafarian. So he was a polarizing figure. So he was a hero and an idol to young Jamaicans, to Jamaicans who are coming into their blackness, to Jamaicans rejecting colony. This is even after independence.
Were your parents fans of him?
No. My parents did not like Bob Marley. In fact, they despised Rastafarians, which just made them in line with mainstream Jamaican thinking. Rastafarians were supposed to be these nasty, disgusting men with head lice who didn't bathe, or they were blackheart men kidnapping children and cutting their hearts out. It was just... It was a major, major, major statement to be a Rastafarian in the 70s, because you're going to pay for it. And Marley, being the most famous and embodiment of that, polarized people. If you were a younger person, Marley was a prophet. If you were older, he's this ignorant, ignorant ganja-smoking musician who suddenly became the voice of world struggle. No, there are people who absolutely hated him, and there are people who thoroughly adored him.
Now, I'm intrigued in the acknowledgements at the back of this epic book that you say that you had researchers working on this project, mm-hmm. even before you knew what the novel was. Can you
right.
explain to me how that works? I mean, what were you briefing them to do?
I find for me writing novels, how do I describe this in a way that makes any sense? It's almost as if I know a story is going to happen in this area. The first thing that comes to me is geography. It's like, I know this is going to happen somewhere here. And it's almost like I send feelers out. I'm like, let me know, what was going on in the 19th? I knew it was going to be the 70s and the 80s. And it was those two decades. And characters start to appear. The first character to appear in this novel, funny enough, was not Marley or any of them. It was the hitman from in Chicago in the 80s.
A minor character.
Yeah, a minor character. But I just start to sort of move in closer and closer. And usually the first things I research is just what's happening in the world at the time.
So you're looking at it from a kind of journalistic point of view. You're looking at cuttings.
Yeah, I'm very much like a journalist. And I think for me to write something, that's what I have to become, really. A sort of journalist for, in this case, it was something that really happened, but a journalist for an imagined world most of the time. And that's what I start doing. I just start to sort of feel a story out, go, where is it? For me, that leads, fortunately or unfortunately, to tons of false starts. I just, you know, it's just how I write.
So are you telling me that of the 76 characters that there are in this book, that maybe you started off with 100 and some of those fell by the way?
No, really. I started off with one. And if that character didn't work, I just quit and went to another one. And that's how I was writing it for a good year and a half, because I thought it was a short novel with one character. I'm just not feeling the magic character yet.
Right.
So I ended up, it's almost like I was like going through a series of auditions for all these characters. And it turns out no one character could carry such a story. And as soon as I realized that, it was a friend who pointed it out to me. I didn't realize it on my own. That's when I realized it was a novel being told by multiple characters.
And how do you keep all those voices in your head? Because there's an extraordinary kind of collision here, spread around the world. So how do you organize this material?
On a very, very practical level, I'd write only one character per day. So I could only pretty much deal with only one person at a time. Because I'm having, it's like if you're doing in-depth interviews, I'm spending the whole day with a character, and most of the time, a lot of times in that book, characters are just sitting down in space and thinking and talking. Mm-hmm. So that basically was the main way I did it. I just sort of spent, I'd only write one character a day.
Did you look to other writers for any kind of guidance about writing about a crime and the world on this scale? I'm thinking about James Ellroy.
Yeah.
For me, the resonance is there.
Oh, totally. I look at books are my tools when I write. I try not to shamelessly rip off anybody or plagiarize anybody. But in terms of, say, the global architecture of the novel, I looked at tons of books. I looked at James Ellroy, Orhan Pamuk, Salman Rushdie, Nadine Gordimer, even if I'm not writing anything that's anything like them, lots of Bolaño. Mm-hmm. But there are also times when a book would clue me into a character that I can't figure out. For example, Weeper, who I was perfectly fine to have Weeper only exist in the mind of another character, Josie Wales. And I love characters like that. It's one of the things I love about, say, Tolstoy. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I realized Weeper has to have a voice, we need to hear from him, I had no idea what he sounded like. He was like character number 60. I'm like, I'm out. I'm out of tactics that have come up with a character. And I went back and reread, because I teach it, Margaret Duras's The North China Lover. And the prose in that book is a lot like what it is, stage directions and notes. Mm-hmm. And it just struck me that a character like Weeper, who is so obsessed with secrecy, who will micromanage any space so that he doesn't reveal he's gay, would stage direct even his own sex. And that's what, and that was a breakthrough for me going back to The North China Lover, and it's like, yeah, I mean, it doesn't sound like, I hope it doesn't sound like The North China Lover, But it's,
it does not.
But the idea of, oh, because the stage direction was duress, whereas in Man, a stage direction is a character. He's obsessed with where the whole fire that window is. Who can see? So his everything in a scene, including just making love, is done in proximity to, I'm 5 feet from the window. He's 4 feet at the door. A plane can only be 100 miles out. It's that's where it came from. And books, that's a very, very sort of day-to-day way in which books help me write. If I'm sort of blocked, I mean, I have a huge, I have like 3 different libraries. And it's always somebody who is far removed from the type of books I write. So, I mean, I don't write anything like duress.
Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. We mentioned your parents before, not approving of Rastafarianism. Your mother was a police detective. So was the conversation around the dinner table about cases? Did you grow up kind of steeped in the culture of crime?
No, not at all. They both parents were very good at keeping that from their kids, which is it's funny because we didn't grow up sheltered, and they weren't neither. You know, my mom has very little use for sentimentality; she tells it how it is, and my father as well. And it's two things I love about them but hated at one point. But it's not as if they brought the work home, but if something like a Bob Marley assassination happened, or if people were talking about violence or murder or so on, they didn't hold back until having those discussions. So it's a weird sense that they didn't try when the world intruded, they made sure this called a spade, this is what's happening. But for the most part, they made sure our lives were pretty stable and middle class and actually kinda boring. But
so how has the success of this book internationally been greeted back in Jamaica? I mean, you don't live there anymore, but you must know.
I know a little bit. I think it's a sign, I think, of how far Jamaica has come that, for the most part, I think it's celebrated. I've been there twice this year. I'm going back again for the third time in June. And I think people are just happy. One, Jamaicans love success.
They do.
Why not?
Why not?
But I also think, particularly with younger Jamaicans who grew up with the culture of silence, because we don't talk in Jamaica, we don't talk about these things. We don't talk about the past, we don't talk about violence. Everybody has these discussions in their homes, but nobody talks about it in a sense where they could be held accountable that they said this. So the idea that a book has set off, has triggered these discussions, has been pretty welcome. But it's still complicated, because I'm also known as the out gay guy in a country that's not too fond of. But even that is changing. I mean, quite a few of the schools in Jamaica actually have gay support groups now, which would never have happened 10 years ago. You know, my school, high school vice principal was talking to me about how some of her students now feel comfortable coming out to her. And that is a major, major, major deal.
It's a fantastic thing.
It's a fantastic thing.
It's a fantastic thing for a book to achieve, and it reminds me a bit of what happened in New Zealand after Once Were Warriors came out, where suddenly the whole issue of domestic violence within the Maori community was blown wide open, and the whole country started to talk about it. It's fantastic when a book has the power to do that.
Yeah.
I also love, and this is completely nothing to do with that, but I love the fact that not only do we have Bob Marley and his life and his music in the book, but Prince gets a look in.
Yeah.
How's that?
I'm a huge Prince fan. I it's so ironic that I ended up moving to Minneapolis. My friends think I moved there to work for Prince. Prince, you know, I bought Purple Rain not long after my 14th birthday in December. It's the first record I ever bought. And I up to that point, it's happened since, but I was just electrified by that record.
And did you ever see him?
No. Never saw him live. Never saw him. And then when I moved to Minneapolis, funny enough, that the problem with moving to Minneapolis is that killed the urgency. I'm like, he's here. I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. He has a concert every week. And there'll be concerts at Paisley Park. And I'm like, Marlon, are you coming? No. What? Where is he going to go?
Wow. There's a lesson.
That was a devastating lesson for me. I took that death very hard.
I can imagine.
I felt like one of my older brothers died.
Wow.
Yeah. Because you know, when I said electrified me, I don't necessarily mean it was a great record. I mean it was almost a sort of a life bringer. Which is not to say I had a horrible childhood or anything, but I kind of did. You don't have to have horrible parents and blah 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 for teenage years to be pretty traumatic. You just need to be the unpopular kid.
That's right. That's absolutely
the
right.
Things that parents can't help. You know, parents can't, for the most part, parents can't help. They're wonderful parents, but you can't stop the bully.
No.
So Purple Rain was just this sort of, for me, this universe, you know, I could enter. And it wasn't just Purple Rain, it was also X-Men comics. It was, you know, reading Dickens and reading, reading X-Men and all of that.
You mentioned X-Men there. Mm-hmm. So I've read that your next book is going to be the first in a fantasy series. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously you don't want to get stuck as the kind of the Jamaica history guy.
Yeah.
So you're going completely into genre. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, because I'm a huge fan of sci-fi and fantasy and crime. They're still my first loves. I mean, I'm not crazy about the term genre. But yeah, I still remember these worlds of wonder that I was exposed to when I was growing up, mostly through comics and sci-fi. I realized really, really late. I mean, I've since seen them. But it took me a while, I think it was in the mid-90s, it hit me that I hadn't seen Star Wars. And I hadn't seen Star Trek. I read the books. The movie tie-in that was like a dollar. That you found in the basement somewhere. And it just hit me when the first time I saw Star Wars, that nothing in Star Wars matched what I saw. I'm like, then which film did I see? I go, oh, hold on, I didn't see the films. I read the books. Star Trek, Wrath of Khan, and yeah, it was the tie-ins, and most of those books had depth because it was the least important part of the merchandise chain. So the writers basically did whatever they wanted,
yeah.
And I told somebody, hey, anybody knows Alan Dean Foster? Tell him I'm his biggest fan because he does the lion's share of these. Book versions of sci-fi films, and those are really, really crucial to me.
Now, one final question I have to ask you this. Mm-hmm. You said some fairly controversial things after the Booker about white middle class female readers, just like me. What's the problem with a reader like me?
What's the problem with a reader like you? Well, what's the problem is that you're not the problem. The problem is the publishing industry making assumptions about you. And I think people think I was making a statement about race or about women. I'm like, no, I'm making a statement about marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Give an example. One of my friends, who's a white woman, who took great offense to what I wrote, and we were talking about it, and then she mentions she had a novel, and it was called Being Polite to Hitler. Isn't that great?
It's a great title.
The publisher said, no, we're going to change it to The Garden.
No.
And I'm like, who's that pandering to? I'm like, see, it's not just, I said people of color because we get a different kind of pandering. Like, this cover can only be this. Must you be this angry? But there you go. There you are, a white woman being pandering to this idea of this white female reader, which I don't think exists. But I said, well, you need something more mainstream. What do you mean mainstream? You mean white? And that's what I'm talking about. This sort of pandering to what they think this market is. That's insulting the market's intelligence. And it's still being done. Most black female writers can tell you the discussion about their book cover. You know, we must have, I call it black girl looking askance in the cover. I'm like, but they're black women. They're not even black women in the novel. It's like, so I, you know, and yeah, and I think, and it's funny, I have a lot of friends who are really, really offended by what I said. I'm like, but you listen to what I'm saying. I'm not talking about, it's not a statement about race, it's a statement about marketing. And it's a statement, and it's this idea that continues to sort of insult the intelligence of the reader, as if a white woman can't handle a cover from a black woman that's not a black woman looking off in the distance. Really? Who is that person that can't handle a cover for, say, Beloved, that really captures the beauty and horror of that novel? Really, who can't handle it? Why give Toni Morrison a cover that's interchangeable with, say, Love, Sweat, Romance, Volume 2? It is a pandering. And pandering has, and the thing about pandering, I mean, trust me, I mean, have you ever seen the books that pander to black women? Those are, look even worse.
How do they look?
Well, for one, regardless of what genre you write, it's the same sort of well-dressed, well-made-up black woman doing nothing on the cover.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you're Tory. Look at the British edition of, say, Toni Morrison's God Help the Child, sorry. And put it right beside, you know, anything, the Black of the Berry Chronicles. It's the same cover. So yeah, the cover that pandered, because there's this idea that black people don't read. Mm-hmm. And to get them to read, you have to make it look like Kim Kardashian is on the cover. Or they won't read it. That's pandering too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the type of book that panders to the black man, because I assume black men don't even read at all. So I think there's a lot of that going on. But I do think that there is this idea the publishing industry has of it's the reader of literary fiction, that it's mostly middle class, upper middle class, and white, and they don't want to be offended, they don't want to be challenged, they don't want to have any sort of conflicts over a book that they may very well be deeply conflicted about. And I think it still happens. One of the things, you know, nobody talks about with that Facebook post is that, you know, it was liked by nearly 700 women of color.
When you said that?
Yeah. It's like, either we're all stupid, or there's a point here.
Yeah.
Actually, it also was liked by quite a few hundred white women as well. So everybody knows there's a point that we're not talking about.
Well, we're talking about it now.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Marlon James.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.